BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
My name is Ross Sutherland. The BBC asked me to make a series about the life of artist Arthur Craven. Craven was a living artwork. He made public scandal into performance art, enraging, confusing, disturbing people wherever he went.
Yes! Man of fashion, chemist, whore, drunk, musician,
this
laborer, painter.
This is the escape artist.
Arthur Craven!
Arthur Craven.
Monsieur Delaunay has a face like an inflamed pig.
Patron saint of the surrealists.
His colours have German accents.
Inventor of performance art.
Oh, asshole!
Fire the starting pistol for modernism.
To understand Dada, to even understand punk rock.
Yes! Arthur Craven!
Alternative comedy.
A little pose in front of the mirror.
Our most daring performers to date.
I write to anger my colleagues.
Cause a scandal in everything that he did.
You should have a look at Arthur Craven.
What a cunt!
Escape artist. There's one famous story from the Arthur Craven canon that I've deliberately held back to the end. It might not be as elaborate as some of Craven's later scandals, but I think it might well be my favourite. Back in November 1913, Craven was still living in Paris, publishing his self-made magazine, Maintenant. Up until this point, Maintenant had contained a mixture of Craven's poetry and articles presented under an assortment of pseudonyms.
I'll say it again at the risk of getting myself locked.
But now, with the release of Maintenant issue 3, Craven began to explore just how much power he had now that he could print and circulate whatever news he wanted. On the front page, in large, bold type, Maintenant 3 declared,
Oscar Wilde est vivant!
Oscar Wilde is alive. This was Arthur Craven's first foray into the fake news business. The article within describes a first-hand account from Craven himself claiming that Wilde had appeared at his front door in March of that year. In reality, Wilde died in the winter of 1900. He'd moved to Paris shortly after his release from Reading Jail in 1897. An ear infection led to encephalitic meningitis. 3 days after diagnosis, Wilde was dead. If Wilde had been alive in 1913, he would have been approaching 60. In Craven's article, Craven initially fails to recognise the huge balding man standing in his doorway. But when the stranger gives his name as Sebastian Melmoth, Wilde's assumed name when he escaped Paris, Craven is immediately brought to tears.
I wanted to fall on him and clasp his neck, to embrace him like a mistress, give him to eat and to drink, put him to bed, dress him, become his procurer. In short, to draw all my money from the bank and fill his pockets.
Worth remembering that this whole scene comes from the imagination of someone who spent their whole life dreaming of Oscar Wilde. Craven's father had attempted to erase all knowledge of Wilde from their family tree, and Craven, in response, spent the rest of his life reasserting that connection. Craven arrived in Paris dressing like Wilde. He used to name-check his connection to Wilde in the ring walk of his boxing matches. Craven practically modelled himself as Wilde's avenging angel. And yet this was a man he never met, someone he experienced only through stories and texts. But now, to the writing of this brand new story in his magazine, Craven was finally able to meet his uncle.
The only words I could succeed in articulating to sum up my innumerable sentiments were Oscar Wilde. Oscar Wilde. The latter understood my trouble and my love and murmured, Dear Fabian.
Wilde calling Craven by his birth name there, as if true names were our deepest secrets. things shared only between the rarest of soulmates. In the article, Wilde reveals to Craven that he's been living incognito since his fake funeral, during which time, Wilde says, he's written a memoir and completed a new collection of poetry. Craven then suggests to Wilde that maybe these new manuscripts could be serialized in future editions of his magazine. Presumably, Craven had plans to add Wilde to his own list of writing pseudonyms. The story of Oscar Wilde's resurrection quickly spread to respectable news sources. Within days of publication, on the other side of the Atlantic, the Washington Herald led on its front page with "Oscar Wilde alive and in Paris," claims nephew. The following Sunday, the New York Times ran a follow-up article trying to track down anyone from Wilde's funeral who could verify seeing Wilde's body go into the coffin. The article contained an additional quote from Craven, now offering a 10,000 franc bet that Wilde was alive and that his coffin in Bagneux Cemetery held no more than paving stones, cotton wool, and a glass jar containing a mysterious final manuscript by Wilde titled Amen. More invented mystery, more gossip. Daring the world to dig up your uncle's coffin doesn't seem like the kindest thing to do to your hero or to anyone. Even considering Craven's usual standards of amoral exploitation, this one feels below the belt. But I don't think Craven could have done this to his hero if, in some way, he hadn't seen what he was doing to his uncle as a kind of gift. Whenever a death is announced in a newspaper, the story is always so banal, so factual. We might feel a little uncomfortable about what Craven did to Wilde, but he did take the dreariness of Wilde's death and turn it back into something more like poetry. He put gaps in it, space for the imagination to roam. Someone once told me that the reason they love poetry is because a poem is strong enough to contain two contradictory truths without collapsing. And I like the idea of thinking about death in the same way, of all of us becoming poems ourselves in death as we slowly escape our own subject matter. So I think Craven did see this as a gift to Wilde. I mean, certainly, this was a gift that was paid back to Craven when he himself disappeared 5 years later on that boat in the Gulf of Mexico.
Fabian Avenarius Lloyd, a.k.a. Arthur Craven, considered extremely intelligent and dangerous.
Whether intentional or not, Craven's friends did to him just what he did to Wilde.
Distinguishing mannerisms, French accent.
They removed the death scene from his story.
Suspected and known aliases. Edward Archinard,
and in its
Isaac
place,
Craven, Dorian,
they left an unsolvable riddle, creating endless threads and conspiracies.
Poet, professor, boxer, dandy, flaneur, forger, critic, sailor,
space for the imagination to roam. The story of Oscar Wilde's resurrection went viral. But none of the newspaper records I've seen speak about how Craven's original article ends. And I actually think this might be the most interesting part of the whole story. In the article, Craven beseeches Wilde to stay and have a drink with him until
the bottle of cherry brandy was empty and the rowdy gradually took birth in me. I brought out 3 litres of Van Ordinaire. "Come on, have a bloody drink!" I exclaimed with the accent of an American boxer, at which he seemed a little shocked. He accepted, emptied his glass at a gulp, and sighed. "I have never drunk as much." "Shut up, old souse!" I yelled, pouring another drink.
Craven starts calling him old carcass, immense cow.
Insulting him amid abominable belching.
Even in Craven's own wish-fulfillment fantasy of meeting his hero, he still messes things up by drinking too much and getting too intense.
To Montmartre! We shall go on a spree. You'll see, we shall be astonishing. And I said again, like Satan, or are you not the king of life? You are a terrible boy, murmured Wilde.
Wilde implores Craven to let him leave, eventually staggering out the front door, with Craven hectoring him down the stairwell into the street.
I watched him disappear into the night, and as life at that minute forced me to laugh, I stuck my tongue out at him and mimicked the action of giving him a hard kick. It no longer rained, but the air was cold. I remembered that Wilde had no overcoat, and I told myself he must be poor. A gush of sentiment inundated my heart. I was sad and full of tenderness. Seeking some consolation, I lifted my eyes. The moon was too beautiful and swelled my pain. I thought now that Wilde had perhaps wrongly interpreted my words, that he had not understood, that I could not be serious, that I had caused him pain.
I think that Craven often uses failure as a theatrical device. So many famous Arthur Craven stunts end with him looking like a fool. Craven likes to make himself the butt of the joke, but unlike his later live stunts, I think this article allows Craven to talk about failure on a much more personal level. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think there's real pain here. A pain of not being understood as an artist or as a person. As Craven says of Wilde, he had not understood that I could not be serious. Maybe we could read this ending as a moment of remorse for anyone that Craven hurt along the way.
Like a madman, I started to run after him. At each corner, I sought him with all the strength of my eyes and cried, Sebastian! Sebastian! Full speed, I raced through the boulevards until I saw that I had lost him. Erring through the streets, I returned slowly, my eyes never leaving the moon. That companionable cunt.
This is the sound of me digging. You know, there were so many things that I planned to do in this series that I never got around to. I thought about writing my own version of Craven's article, where Craven comes back from the dead and turns up on my doorstep, except rather than having like a drunken bonding session, I was planning to hit him over the head with a chair and kill him, bury him in an unmarked grave somewhere. But I never got around to writing that scene in the end. Another thing I wanted to do was compare Arthur Craven's life to the post-truth world we live in today, our age of reality wars, each news media outlet broadcasting from its own parallel universe, our burgeoning industry of professional heels, Craven-esque figures that we love to hate. We're surrounded by echoes of Craven. The avant-garde devices he once used to complicate life and art have become part of our standard interface with the world. But I don't know. I mean, it's not as if Arthur Craven was patient zero for some kind of post-truth disease. Craven was just responding to the same problems in his time that we have in ours. He himself was born into a world of lies. A world where his uncle could be condemned for his sexuality. A world where 16 million lives could be lost because of political malpractice and clumsy diplomacy. Craven knew these things were nonsensical fictions, and so he resisted them. He tried to write himself out of their story. I'm sure there are things that Craven could have taught us about how to navigate the world today, about how to escape from some of the stories that are forced upon us. Or maybe it's more that we need to learn from Arthur Craven's mistakes. The pain he inflicted on the people he left behind. Maybe this series should have more been about the price of escape.
Okay, that's probably deep enough.
Dropping the box in now.
And we just got to cover it up.
Yeah, it would have probably been good to do that. Maybe I should have done that rather than waste all that time hiding an intricate treasure map across the length of this series. It was pretty hard work making sure that every episode contained a reference to a shape, which could in turn be reimagined as a letter, which, when all those letters were correctly arranged, would lead to a web address that would lead to a map that would lead to a certain metal box containing inside it none other than, well,
there we go.
You know, there's
all covered up.
Nothing in that box, don't you?
Like I was never here.
The Escape Artist, Episode 10, The Resurrection, was written, presented, and produced by me, Ross Sutherland. It was produced for the BBC by Melvin Rickaby. The voice of Arthur Craven was David Reed. The music was by Jeremy Wormsley. The editor was James Cook.